You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everybody, and finally I'm happy to say welcome back to the Wild Wild Podcast. We've had a kind of a summer break, it feels like, but here we are. And so my name is Adrian Smith. I'm very happy to introduce to you and welcome back to the show erstwhile co-host Rod Barnett.
Hello everyone, glad to be back.
I think I stole the phrase erstwhile co-host from your podcast, so apologies for any copyright infringement there.
Oh, trust me, if it's been said by me on any podcast, I've stolen it from someone else.
Yes, good point. So I thought it would be good, before we sort of launch into our little mini season we've got going here, as it's been a while, we'd like to keep up to date on a few things. So one thing that I've been noticing in the last couple of months since we were last on was how many cult, in inverted commas, Italian movies, 88 films here in the UK, are releasing or announcing, at least. And some real surprises. And the one that really caught my eye was the 4K and Blu-ray release of one of your favorites, I know, Ark of the Sun God.
I was absolutely shocked to see that. Not just that it was getting released, but, you know, a 4K? Holy crap.
Yeah. I know, Margheriti in 4K. Even though, like, at least more than half of his films are still not available on Blu-ray. Some not even on DVD. But now we're already pushing into 4K, which is kind of, it's exciting in some ways and also slightly frustrating that there are still others we can't get, you know.
Oh, I know. Some of his best films are just not available in digital format at all. It's insane.
And I like the, and if anyone has seen this online, the cover, I think I might have tweeted this, the artwork, it looks like Graham Humphrey's artwork for the release with our favourite Luigi Pagosi right there on the front with his pag beard.
Luciano Pagosi?
Oh, sorry, I just said Luigi. I've got Luigi on the brain. Luciano Pagosi with his pag beard on the front cover there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's exciting. But they've announced a new restoration of Whip and the Body. So I'm sure lots of people will be quite pleased to hear about that.
Yes, definitely, since no one's been completely pleased with most of the Blu-rays that have come out of that film so far.
Yeah, and they're also doing, I think it's going to be in 4K, Tentacles.
Which, so, yeah, I have tried so hard to like that movie. I really have.
I mean, yeah, for me, it's all about Shelley Winter's hat.
I get it. I really do.
It's the hat is the whole, yeah, it's such an odd film, with very little tentacle action. I think there are more tentacles in the box artwork than in the film.
I love watching it, trying to ascertain whether or not Henry Fonda knew what the film he was making was actually about.
Yes.
And I have my doubts.
Me too. So 88 films are really knocking it out of the park these days. They've also, a film I've never seen, actually. I think they're doing it in 4K as well, The Hell of the Living Dead. Do you know much about that film?
Oh my, yes. That's a Bruno Mattei joint.
It's Bruno Mattei. I should have known.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. In the right mood, Bruno Mattei films can be an absolutely entertaining bit of 100 minutes of film joy. A lot of people would specify Hell of the Living Dead as one of his more entertaining, but entertaining in the wrong way, films.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I was thinking of the shark one that a lot of people have an affection for. Is that Deep Blood? Is that one? That one here?
Oh, God, is that him? See, I lose track. Yeah. Because one of the things that Bruno Mattei began to do incredibly heavily, especially in the 90s, he was already doing it in the 80s, don't get me wrong, but by the 90s, there was less of an attempt to hide the fact that he was getting money to do productions that were essentially just complete ripoffs of Hollywood films. And by ripoffs, I don't mean movies that were inspired by a hit Hollywood film. I mean movies where you could sit there and put the two movies side by side and go, holy crap, it's the same movie. And it got kind of weird, especially in the 90s when I ended up getting a bootleg. Forgive me, people. Bootlegs, yes.
I don't know. I don't even know what that is.
Well, I ended up getting a bootleg of a Bruno Mattei film made in the sometime in the late 90s. And I started watching it, and I realized that it was nothing more than a remake of the Nicolas Cage film 8mm. With just a gender flip on the main character. That was the only difference. Well, that and the fact that I think 8mm is a piece of garbage. But I think it's a terrible film. I think it is unintentionally hilarious. And so watching Bruno Mattei make a complete remake in Italian of an unintentionally hilarious Cage film from the 90s was honestly, it's unforgettable. So
on about a tenth of the budget, I would imagine.
Oh, if that.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I guess with any of his, Joe D'Amato is often put into the same sort of bracket as Bruno Mattei. When you've made that many films, some of them are going to be entertaining, some of them are going to be massive clunkers, and you kind of just take your life into your own hands as you go into those things.
Yes.
But it's interesting that, again, Bruno Mattei in 4K.
I know.
I believe 88 films have also just doing Cannibal Holocaust as well, I think.
Are
Again,
they?
And in 4K. Somebody's done Cannibal Holocaust in 4K. I think it was 88. I don't know, I've lost track.
I don't know.
But anyway, they but again, it'll be in the UK, it will be the slightly trimmed Cannibal Holocaust rather than the full-strength Cannibal Holocaust, which I guess, but some people would prefer that anyway. But I know we don't need to talk about it. We've talked a lot about Cannibal Holocaust before, so let's not dwell on that. But anyway, so there you go. So that was all the kind of latest interesting news that I'd picked up on. Is there anything that you want to mention, Rod, or anything that you've been involved with that's recently come out or been announced?
Nothing new that has been announced. There are a number of things on the burners, but that can't be talked about quite yet. I can say that one thing that I've been involved with has been delayed because they're searching for full length cuts of particular films and things like that, and so there have been delays, and it becomes even more important to not talk about them while these things are going on.
Yeah. Now, without giving anything away, is this the one that you told me about off air, where you noticed that the version of the film they were using was not complete?
Yes. Where I...
Well done.
Yeah. I was like, oh God, where is all the sleaze? And was a bit of a shocking moment, and luckily the response from the company in question was exactly what I would hoped, which was whoa. Where is all the, wait, where is all the sleaze? So
they needed their sleaze detective to pick up on these things that everyone else had clearly missed.
Oh no, I don't know that I want to be known as the sleaze detective.
That's got a ring to it.
Well, I will admit that that is true, but
I'd watch that movie. I'm sure, and it sounds like something Andy Sidaris would have already made.
Oh, all I'm picturing is that scene at the end of Cannibal Holocaust, where the people who've been watching all this found footage just, you know, walk out onto a New York City street, kind of trying to clear their mind of the filth that they've been watching. That's what I'm thinking about.
Good. Well, okay. So, and of course, in terms of things that haven't been announced yet, that also includes a project that you and I were involved with that hopefully will be announced soon.
Very true. Very true.
Oh, one other thing that I've just remembered. There's a new company appeared seemingly out of nowhere in the UK called Treasured Films. They have a Facebook page, but not an active website yet, as far as I can see. And I don't know how there's any more sort of room in the market for this, but they're launching a brand new boutique company, and the first film that they're doing is Margheriti's The Last Hunter.
Oh yeah, I did read about that. That's true.
And I found out about this. They got in touch with me through my Margheriti blog, which is sadly neglected of late, because I'd written about the Margheriti documentary that his son Eduardo made about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're including that with English subtitles. So that'll be the first English-friendly release of that documentary.
Excellent.
on this Blu-ray, which is quite exciting, because before, I think it was made, it's only been available, I think, in Japan and Germany. So the version that I watched was a sort of fan subbed version. So that's quite cool. That's a great documentary, about an hour long. Luigi Cozzi is in there a lot, as he is in pretty much every documentary you watch these days.
Mm-hmm.
But also, of course, Eduardo and various other people. So we're suddenly being spoiled with Margheriti goodness. But anyway, so that brings us to the reason we're here, which is Luigi Cozzi, or Cozzi, Cozzi. I'm going to say it either way, all the way through, I think.
Well, I did notice that I've now heard him pronounce his own name, and it is, he does pronounce it Cozzi. So.
Yeah, Cozzi. So anyway, we'll just call him Luigi, our old friend Luigi.
That'll do.
And so we're going to do a little mini season here as an excuse, really, to talk about Luigi Cozzi. We've already covered one of his films or two of his films. One, I think. We did Star Crash a while ago.
Yeah.
A while back. And so this is an excuse to talk about him a bit more and focus on some films that are not likely to fit into a specific season anytime soon. So I picked some films pretty much just because I wanted to do them. So the first film that we're going to talk about, and this will be our first giallo of the podcast, so that's another reason to bring it in, is his film The Killer Must Kill Again, also known as Il Ragno, or The Spider, and we can talk about how appropriate that is or not. Italian title, I'll have a go, L'Assassino è costretto ad uccidere ancora. I think I stumbled over uccidere, but anyway, The Killer Must Kill Again. So this is Luigi Cozzi, 1975. And 1975, according to the friend of your show, Troy Howarth,
mm-hmm.
friend to all of us in many ways, according to his book, there were 13 giallos out in 1975. Rod, quick pub quiz question. Can you tell me which is probably the most famous giallo that came out in 1975?
Oh, it would have to be Profundo Rosso, Deep Red.
Hey, well done. Very good. That is correct. You could have said the police are blundering in the dark. I would have also let you have that one.
But, I don't know that that would be one of the best. No, no.
Oh, have you seen that? Oh,
yes.
Dear.
Yes, I have. It is not very good, but I have seen it.
Now, that one is in one of those Forgotten Jolly box sets. And it made me wonder why, when I was watching this, this feels like a Forgotten Jolly. I know it's had it had a DVD release, I think, Mondo Macabro, a few years ago, I think. But this is certainly one that I would like to see end up in one of those box sets or a similar.
I agree with you. It's an exceptional film, and it's very easy to categorize into the Giallo grouping. But I have to admit that I think that this movie, and we can talk about this whenever, but it seems it breaks a lot of the standardized rules of the Giallo pretty hard and heavy, and I think that it's impressive for that, and it also benefits the movie quite a bit, that it kind of nods its head at the conventions of the genre and then kind of deviates from them in really interesting ways. And what's even more surprising, I've always, you know, came out in 1975, I always thought of it as fitting perfectly into 1975 as far as, you know, that being kind of the period of time when you would start to see people probably getting bored with making the same kind of films. But it actually was shot in 73.
Oh, right. Oh, good point.
Which is weird. I mean, that means that people were already thinking, we've really got to shake this genre up a little bit, even earlier than I would have considered probable. So.
Mm. Yeah, because by 75, and obviously Deep Red, which is sort of like the culmination of all Giallo films rolled into one. Mm-hmm. But also, there's a couple of other notable ones like that that year, like Suspicious Death of a Minor.
Yes.
And Strip Nude for Your Killer, which is almost a kind of spoof Giallo.
It is. Strip Nude for Your Killer is almost like it was constructed to be the sleaziest film humanly imaginable. So,
yes. While the sleaze detective would know.
Oh God! Now, I'm leaning into that designation, aren't I?
So this was Luigi Cozzi's second feature film as director, but he had such an interesting career, and obviously once when we do get to talk to him in a couple of weeks or so, we can ask him a few things about that. But he'd already made by this point a kind of experimental feature film called Tunnel Under the World, which is really fun. We actually get a glimpse of that in this movie, which was interesting. But he also made an episode, he made a Giallo-style thriller, an episode for an Italian TV show. His episode was called The Neighbor. But he'd also, I think by this point, perhaps more significantly, he'd been writing. He wrote Four Flies on Grey Velvet, and he had a hand in writing the Cat of Nine Tales. Another release we've just had mentioned by Severin is they're doing Dario Argento's The 5 Days, the Cinque Giornate, on 4K. And Luigi Cozzi was involved in writing that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he's making his second feature film here, and it does feel like it feels like you're in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing. And it's because he's spent these years working with people like Argento, writing and making really interesting stuff. And even before that, through the 60s, he was a science fiction writer, mainly. And he set up, apparently he established Italy's first fanzine called Futuria Fantasia. And he was publishing his own short stories, and so he was very creative. He was making lots of short films as well on Super 8 and all the kind of stuff that people do. So, you know, by 1973, when he's actually making this film, he's been incredibly prolific and creative for a good 10 years. And so the film, in some ways, like you said, because it's sort of shaking things up a bit, it feels quite fresh, like it's not the 100th film from somebody who's just been churning these things out every week.
Yeah,
but also it does show, I think, a lot of sort of, you know, somebody who's very assured behind the camera, somebody who really feels like they know what they're doing.
It does, and it's always been a shock to me because I'm not gonna hide this. I came to The Killer Must Kill Again when it came out on on DVD from Anno Macabro back in the early 2000s. And it was a great introduction to the film because, you know, you're not looking at it through gauze on some bootleg somewhere. And also there's some extras to give it context and to make you understand what the heck you understand what you're looking at and how it came to be. And that's great. But what struck me was that I had already kind of pegged Luigi Cozzi as a filmmaker who I might enjoy the movies, but I wasn't going to think I wasn't going to put them on the same plane as, say, the thrillers made by Argento or Bava. But after, you know, because by that time I had seen films like, you know, his Hercules movies and Star Crash. And it's like, don't get me wrong, I love those movies, but they do not inspire within you the desire to see this man's work from birth to death. They make you think that, well, when I come across one of these, I need to, you know, crack open a beer and have myself a good time. But The Killer Must Kill Again, I still to this day feel that it is his most assured, most well-directed and just solid piece of thriller concoction. I think it's such a good movie, and it is such a great kind of jumping off point for any director that he really deserves to be proud of this film. And it points out to me that I really need to pay more attention to the fact that there are a couple of his movies made right after this that I've still never seen, and I need to kind of think about getting my hands on one day just to see, you know, kind of maybe the growth or how he changed from the filmmaker who would far from aping his collaborator Argento, he seemed to be wanting to like use the things that he learned from people like working with Argento to do something that kind of took left and right turns from it while still being something tight and really entertaining.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting? I suppose maybe because it did come a bit late in the cycle, but this was his only giallo. And you sort of wonder why that was when other directors were, like I said, just knocking them out every week. And he could, he seems to be so confident in the thriller format that it's surprising that he didn't really do that again. I suppose the closest he got was something like Paganini Horror or The Black Cat later on, but those are much more sort of fantastical compared to this, where this is just quite nihilistic, but very well constructed. And it does make you wonder. Like you said, that he made a couple of films straight after this, mm-hmm. but neither of those are giallos. One is a sort of sex comedy mm-hmm. that is out there, but it's only available in Italian with no, I can't find any subtitles to it, which is a shame because I wanted to do that one. That one's called La Portiera Nuda, the Naked Porter. And I thought, oh, we could do that because no one ever talks about that one, but now I know why. and then he did another one called The Last Concert, which actually stars Richard Johnson, who was knocking around Rome for most of the 70s. But that one doesn't seem to be available anywhere, as far as I can see. So The Killer Must Kill Again, and again, just, you know, DVD release about 20 years ago, and that's it. It seems like Luigi's career pre-Star Crash has been pretty much just ignored commercially ever since, which is sort of a shame.
It's a bit of a shock, especially when there there is evidence in a Region 1 DVD release of this particular film that should point people toward, you know, it at the very least. I wonder what in the world is going on.
Yeah, it's interesting. So shall we dig into the movie? So we've got, it's such an interesting plot. It starts out as kind of strangers on a train, and I felt at first like, oh, this is very Hitchcock. It feels almost like Brian De Palma doing Hitchcock. It's so close to Hitchcock in the first few minutes, but then it spins off into something else. George Hilton, I don't know if we've talked about him on the podcast before, but what a cool guy he is. He's obviously kind of giallo and Italian genre cinema royalty. Do you have any favorites of George Hilton films?
Oh man, favorites? Yeah, quite a few. A lot of people will point to the spaghetti westerns he was involved in. But I'll be honest, don't get me wrong, he's great in every film I've ever seen him in. Don't get me wrong. He's always, past a certain point in his career, which I think would have been, you know, kind of the mid to late 60s, everybody knew exactly how to cast this guy. Because he's so good at so many types of things, and he seems to be able to pull it off on screen. But my favorite films of his aren't the spaghetti westerns. They are those giallos, the things that he's, you know, he's known for both. But films like Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward and A Case of the Scorpion's Tail, All the Colors of the Dark, those are the movies that I think of. The Case of the Bloody Iris. I think he is... He's just one of those perfect actors for those types of movies, because he is, in some weird way, just capable of getting across both a certain sincerity when he wants to, but also the feeling that there's probably a lot more going on behind his eyes, and that may be good for you or it may be bad for you. And he's just exceptional at this. Plus, I mean, he's a very handsome man, and the camera loves him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I had dinner with him once. I think.
Really?
I went. Yeah, I think so. He died about 3 years ago. But back in 2015, I went to an academic conference in Rome that was based entirely around The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. The day I arrived, and it was so hot, and I was carrying my luggage, trying to find this restaurant where everybody was meeting. And so I was a bit tired and I didn't really pay much attention. But he was there at the dinner. And we sat on the sat outside on the street of this restaurant somewhere in Rome. And at that point, as I've said before, I've come to Italian film quite late. So I didn't really appreciate who he was properly at the time. So, but yeah, he was there. Edwidge Finech was supposed to be there as well, but she never turned up. Which was a shame, but yeah, he was there. So seemed like he was quite a nice, approachable sort of guy. I didn't speak to him much. I think he did sign something for me, maybe. I can't even remember. I was so hot and exhausted. I wasn't fully appreciative of the opportunity that I had there. But anyway, he's great and he's very cool in this movie as this kind of slick business guy who's actually in a lot of debt, mm-hmm. and has married a rich heiress wife, Norma, and who I think she's Spanish, isn't she? I was wondering whether you had come across her in any of your... Oh, no, she's Mexican. Oh, maybe not then. I thought she was Spanish.
Oh, the actress? Yeah.
Yeah, who plays the wife. I don't know whether she'd done Spanish cinema or just Mexican cinema, but... Tere Velasquez, her name is.
Oh yeah. Oh, I don't know that I have seen her in. Let's put it this way. I've seen a couple of movies that she was in, but I have to admit that I don't remember her as standout specifically. For instance, I've seen her in a Santo movie, Santo and the Anonymous Death. But I don't specifically remember her within it, which, you know, maybe...
What a great name.
Well, yeah, it's a Santo movie. I'm already distracted, so I'm staring.
Because this is it's a Spanish co-production, so like half the cast, it appears. It's a Spanish-French co-production.
Yeah.
So aside from George Hilton, most of the other cast are Spanish or Mexican in her case. Or I think our killer, he's French. With such an unusual face, but and the police inspector, he was Spanish. So, but that was happening a lot, I guess, wasn't it, with these films in the 70s? There's a lot of Spanish crossover with these, and the Spanish were making their own giallo type films as well, anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't we get into the plot here a little bit? But because this is a film that I think maybe a lot of people may not have seen, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but we can certainly, because there are so many interesting twists and turns that I don't want to give too much away. But we could certainly begin with the setup, which I mentioned before is very Hitchcockian. So George Hilton then with his wife, they live in an amazing, what looks like a yellow plastic box. It's a very kind of 70s futuristic, everything is shiny and plastic apartment that they live in, which I liked a lot. It reminded me of, well, there's a lot of Giallo films on there with where everyone's very futuristic looking in their houses. Maybe I like that a lot because here in the UK we all still tend to live in Victorian houses, so I thought that was particularly cool. And also, of course, yellow. The whole thing was yellow, which I'm sure was not a coincidence.
Yeah, according to the commentary track that was included on the old Mondo DVD, that was not a coincidence, yeah.
He's got this wife. They're arguing about money and also women because his wife suspects him of having an affair because a woman keeps ringing their house. I think, is he an architect or something? He's got some sort of business and claims that it's just a client and all this. But anyway, he is sick of his wife and basically just wants her money, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
So he goes off for a drive while he's in a huff. And then he drives to the what looks like the local shipping canal and witnesses a man with a dead woman in his trunk, getting her out and putting her into the driver's seat. And he then proceeds to push the car into the canal, which, crucially, it doesn't sink all the way. It reminded me of Psycho. I don't know, again, if that's a coincidence or not, but the... In Psycho, when he's put the car with Marion Crane in the boot and then he puts it into the swamp and it gets stuck halfway, it doesn't sink all the way down. So I don't know whether that's a reference to Psycho or not, but the car doesn't sink. It's still there at the end of the movie. Which, if you're trying to get rid of a body, that doesn't seem to be particularly smart. But then, this is not the smartest... it's either not a very smart killer or, as Troy points out, he's just very unlucky.
I think that his lack of luck is what I would lean into with a description of this poor sucker, because from his steely nature and just his determination and his very cold way in which he goes about what he's doing, I doubt this is the first person he's murdered and gotten rid of a body. This just feels like something that he has done. This feels like something he's done before, you know?
Yeah. But it's so kind of farcical that you could, if they wanted to, they could have lent into the comedic potential of this film a bit more. Because it's almost like he's done a thing and he thinks he's done it. And then it's like, oh, what now? Something else has gone wrong. And you can almost hear a kind of wah, 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 wah on the soundtrack as things just keep going wrong for this hapless, sleazy murderer.
Once again, that's turning the kind of genre conventions on their head in a really interesting way, because he seems, I mean, to look at him, you'd think he would be this incredibly competent, very machine-like creature of death, and yet at every turn, circumstances just get in the way. I mean, one little mistake leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, until he's having to correct all these mistakes. It's
like, oh, who have I got to kill now?
Exactly.
And it reminds me, again, coming back to Hitchcock, it reminds me of Frenzy. And maybe this is also deliberate because Frenzy came out in 72. So that would be the year before Kotze was making this. And there's that great scene, in very sort of black humor scene in Frenzy, where the killer realizes that he's left. I think he's dumped a body in a sack and then put it on the back of a potato truck that's driving off into the country, and he thinks, hooray, I've got rid of this body. But then he discovers the body's got his type in or something, like there's a clue and he's got to go and get it. And there's this hilarious scene of him wrestling around with this corpse on the back of this truck trying to get the thing out, and there are potatoes bouncing off down the road. It's played very much as sort of funny, but again, that sort of reminded me of this sort of hapless killer where stuff just doesn't. He thinks he's got it. He's done this perfect crime, but this stuff keeps going wrong.
Yeah.
But so this is his first moment where things have gone wrong. There's a witness to him pushing this car into the water, and so George Hilton here, Giorgio, just watches the whole thing, and then just walks up to the guy. I mean, if I was that guy, if I was a murderer and somebody had witnessed me getting rid of the body, wouldn't your first instinct be to just kill him?
And dump his body and chuck him in the canal as well, yeah.
Exactly. But instead he lights his cigarette and they have a nice chat, which I thought was pretty funny. So could you summarize what Giorgio's proposition is to this guy?
Well, it's very simple, and you're right to lean into the Hitchcock vibe because it is very similar to, although there's not a crisscross kind of I do one thing for you and you do one thing for me situation, yeah. like in Strangers on a Train, but it is a very similar vibe, which is, look, I know that you've killed this person and sunk their body in the canal here. I will keep my mouth shut, and I will even pay you if you will essentially do the same thing that you're obviously, you know, pretty hip to do, pretty yeah. much involved with
some
here.
Skills.
Seems like a hobby. Not sure. If you will do this, but if you just do it to someone that I specify, which would be my wife. And so they have a couple of conversations, come to an agreement, and there you go. And you got to say, you got to be impressed with the clanking gargantuan gonads on the George Hilton character who prances up to this man he's just seen, you know, do away with the evidence of a murder and says, hey, look,
business deal.
let's talk a business deal here that will be mutually beneficial.
It's interesting, isn't it, that he would just think, hey, he's clearly a man who's looking for opportunity, and marrying this woman was presumably made for similar reasons, however long ago that was. So they make this agreement, but they need to meet together to plan it all out a bit more. But then I think he goes back home to his wife and he apologizes for the row they had earlier. And then they have this kind of psychedelic sex scene. And then the next day, George Hilton and an unnamed killer are just hanging out. They seem to be having a nice day together where they talk all the plans. Mm-hmm. And they go to an ice rink, which was kind of an interesting choice, to just sit and watching skaters whilst they talk through their evil scheme. And then they go to the cinema, and this is where Cozy gets in his some clips from his first movie, The Tunnel Under the World.
Yeah.
So we actually get to, because that film is not available anywhere. I think it's been shown at some festivals, but you can't see that. So it's quite interesting to get some shots of that movie. But then also there's a little cameo where Luigi Cozzi is actually playing the projectionist in the cinema, which I thought was a nice touch. And so they're watching this film and they're talking again, like planning it all out. It's going to be the perfect crime. Right? What can go wrong?
It turns out quite a bit.
Everything. So the film was going to be called The Spider. Who are we saying is the spider here?
Well, see, that's a fantastic question, because to my imagination, it would be the George Hilton character who seems to be, you know, weaving a web, but at the same time, maybe it's just the murderer, because we don't learn anything about this murderer other than he is this creature who's willing to kill, seems to do it on a regular basis, and is willing to do it for money.
Yeah.
And so to me the spider doesn't really seem to be anybody in particular, not one of the characters. It seems to be the circumstances of the crime itself, and how that crime itself is a web that catches everybody that comes anywhere near it. And like I say, I don't know that that's how Cozzi would see it. I think he sees one of the characters as quote unquote the spider, But to me, it's the web is all, you know, is all the tendrils of things that stretch out from that, from, well, yeah, the single crime, the killing of the wife.
Maybe it's greed itself.
Oh, that's a good call. That's not bad. Yeah.
Perhaps. Yeah. There's a there's a whole essay that could be written on that one. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So far, so Hitchcock. We get to the next night and the murder is all kind of arranged. He's gone out and he's told his wife, oh, a friend of mine from work is coming round, so let him in when he comes. And, you know, so she does. So she lets this guy into the apartment and he's got a headache. So she's gone off to get him a drink of water and some aspirin. But of course, when she comes back, he's hiding around the corner, and he makes one of his first of many mistakes, which is to kill her using the phone cord from... because the whole thing is they're supposed to be pretending this is a kidnapping, right? I don't think we mentioned that.
Right.
He wants... Georgia wants it to look like she's been kidnapped. So if you're going to kidnap somebody, you're then going to ring with your list of demands. So how are you going to ring them and give them your demands if you've just ripped their phone out of the wall? So if you ask me, that was the first. Because when the detective turns up, he's looking around going, I don't know. If this is a kidnapping, they're rubbish at what they're doing. Because they've made all these rookie errors. And that seemed to be the first one, is you don't disable the phone of the house you're going to ring to ask for a ransom. So the police are on the case pretty quick. But obviously before that, so he's killed the wife, and this is where another mistake occurs, which is he just carries her out. He's got his car outside and he puts her in the boot, but then he just goes back in, but he leaves the keys in the ignition.
Yes.
I mean, this is Rome. It's 1975. We've seen enough Poliziotteschi films to know that crime is rife in the big city.
I mean, presumably that is how he's getting away with being a murderer.
That's true.
It's not even Rome. It's
oh, sorry, it's Milan, isn't it? Milan, yeah. We're in Milan. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also
rife.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm not downgrading the crime level. I'm just saying that the idea is that I'm going to assume one of the ways that the killer is getting away with not getting caught up to this point is that there is so much crime that either the cops are completely overwhelmed or he's just kind of hiding his murders in amongst all the other crimes that are being committed.
And I think it's probably a stolen car anyway, because I don't think he seems to mind stealing cars. But yeah, he's left the keys in the ignition, and then he goes back into the apartment to clean up, and he's getting rid of his fingerprints and all this kind of stuff. And then just the funniest thing, and I really like the way that this is done, is he walks out of the apartment, and we just cut to a wide shot, and the car isn't there.
I know, and the look on his face is...
And he's just looking around like, what the hell?
Yeah, because it's definitely the last thing he thought was going to happen.
It's the last thing any of us expect, I think. Like, because before I watched this, I didn't read any plot synopsis at all. So, because in the plot synopsis on the IMDb, it gives away the fact that a thrill-seeking young couple steal the killer's car. So if you've read that, then you're just waiting for that to happen. But I genuinely hadn't read any of this. So when it happened, if this film wanted to be a comedy, that's a good comedic moment. The car is just gone, and the look on his face, like, what?
Oh, it's just amazing that is the jumping off point, because that is the moment where this movie takes its first real hard left turn from what you're expecting of the genre,
Because he's just so surprised. But then we kind of cut to a young couple laughing as they drive away in the car, saying, oh, yeah, it's dead easy to steal a car. You shouldn't leave your keys in a car, and having a great time. Oh, dear. So that was pretty funny. So then he goes and steals another car, which sets off an alarm, I think.
He's got to chase after them.
He's waking up the whole street trying to hotwire this car and turn the alarm off. So the police that's when the police turn up, because they just, you know, they come to investigate that, and then they find the dead wife, or the missing wife, I should say. And Giorgio is called, and then Giorgio is back at home with the police, thinking this is all playing out exactly as I planned, and the kidnappers are going to call and the rich father-in-law is going to get all the money together. And as far as he's concerned, this is all going great. Cut to our nameless killer, who we haven't named him, have we? Antoine Saint-John.
Well, that's the actor's name, but yeah. The character is
never named. Now, he has got the most amazing cheekbones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his face is extraordinary. It almost looks like he's wearing a mask of a person. Like, that can't be a real face. He also reminded me a little bit of Joe Shishido. Do you know the Japanese actor from Branded to Kill?
Mm-hmm.
The guy that got artificial cheekbones put in and looks like a hamster. He reminded me a bit of that. He's got such extraordinary cheekbones. They're like, they're like Timothy Chalamet cheekbones. Like, you could cut yourself if you got too close on those sharp cheekbones. But anyway, so he's got this amazing face. He looks like a wrong one.
What's killing me is that I honestly thought, just from the kind of performance he puts in here and his amazing facial features, just the way he looks, that he was going to be in a lot more films than it turns out that he was in. So,
yeah.
I've seen him in DocuSucker and My Name Is Nobody, this film. I don't remember him from The Wind and the Lion, the John Milius film, but that's only because I haven't seen it in forever. But yeah. He's also in Fulci's Beyond.
Yes, he's the painter, isn't he?
Yeah. At
the beginning.
Yeah.
He's the crucified
painter.
He's
got some facial hair. Yeah, he's got some facial hair.
Yeah,
there,
yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a little different.
Yeah, but it seems like by then he's just doing effectively quite small roles. I mean, this is a star role for him.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, apparently he was a stage actor. And I suspect that the reason why his work on screen wasn't as extensive as I assumed it would be is because he was probably doing more stage work than he was film work.
Yeah, it's a shame because he's quite such an extraordinary presence. So he's racing off into the night to try and figure out where he's gone. And I don't know how he does it, but he's very good at direction and he gets it right straight away, like heads out to the main highway out of Milan. But he goes in the right direction and basically just follows this couple because they're driving to the coast for a romantic getaway. Well, I say romance. There's very little romance involved.
Yeah.
The main guy.
Let's put it bluntly. The couple that have stolen this car, or really it's the boyfriend who's stolen the car. It's
Luca, I think it is.
Yeah. There are a couple of actors we should speak about, but essentially they're just... she is a virginal teenager who seems to have kind of given her boyfriend the impression that if they were to go to a house by the sea, then she would actually have sex with him. And so
that's all he needed. So he steals the nearest car and heads to the beach.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actress for just a second because she's worth speaking about.
Yeah. Christina Galbo,
mm-hmm.
who again is Spanish.
Yeah, yeah, and the earliest role I remember seeing her in was the fantastic film The House That Screamed, which I highly recommend.
Oh, yeah.
She's one of a large cast of actresses in that who are working their tails off in that film. That's a great movie. She was also in What Have You Done to Solange?
Mm-hmm.
And Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. She's very memorable in Let Sleeping Corpses Lie.
Is that the Manchester Morgue film?
Yes, same film.
Yeah. Okay. Now, are you telling me that you've never seen Sex Life in a Women's Prison?
You know what? It's possible, but I don't know. The problem I run into is that all those films tend to run together for me.
Yeah, she's done some interesting films. Obviously, Solange is the main one that I recognize her from. But she did a lot of films, she did some films in the UK as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, Solange, I guess, was in the UK, but she did a couple of others in the UK. So yeah, I think she's really good in this. I mean, Troy Howarth is less complimentary of her performance, but I think she played that character really well.
Oh, I completely agree, yeah.
Yeah, I think she's very good. Her boyfriend, on the other hand, is a total... Well, I won't use the word I was about to say because, you know, well, not that this is a family podcast, but still, he's just horrible. He's, incidentally, he was married to Ornella Muti, which is not bad. But he was in Lisa and the Devil as well. That's probably where most people recognize him
from. Yeah, he is a beautiful looking man.
Yeah.
And he has this face that, you know, if done right, if cast properly, like in something like Lisa and the Devil, you can see him, you can kind of project a lot of different things upon his facial features. And I think that works to good effect in Lisa and the Devil.
Is it in this film, he's just a face that you want to punch.
Oh, well, that comes down to the character, because my goodness, he's a scumbag.
Oh, he really is.
Well, and that brings up something that I think might be worth discussing just briefly here, which is often the giallo genre is construed as being misogynistic, and honestly, sometimes the films work really hard to earn that word as a descriptor. I mean, truly. But honestly, Luca, don't get me wrong, he's not the killer. He's not a rapist. He's none of those things. But he's just an opportunistic, you know, he's exactly what you would expect from someone of his age, which is he's got one thing on his mind. Yeah. That one thing is paramount.
It's between
above
his
all.
Legs.
Yeah, exactly, and more actually between a woman's legs. Yeah. And so the only thing that he's going to, the only thing that's going to ever motivate him seems to be just trying to do anything to get into the position where he can actually have sex.
Where he can get into a position.
Yes, one of several. But he definitely seems as
he's
if he's
scumbag.
He's a scumbag, exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, he's able to get away with it. You can see why this absolutely gorgeous young woman would be attracted to him, because he is incredibly handsome.
Yeah.
And he's just slick enough to fool her for whatever short period of time they've actually been, you know, together as a couple.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, because the dynamics and the character of the characters here really feel believable, which is kind of something that's not necessary within this kind of genre. You don't necessarily need to spend enough time with the characters to feel like you understand how they're together and what they're doing and how they kind of interact with each other. But one of the stranger things about this movie is that we spend kind of the middle section of this film with them a lot.
It suddenly feels like it's a different movie. It really threw me, because I was expecting this George Hilton film. And then suddenly he's like out of the picture for most of the film.
For most of the center. He's the instigator at the beginning, and he's there at the wrap up when it all, shall we say, comes to a head. And then it all, you know, the centerpiece is dealing with, you know, the murderer's problems.
And they just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And so the, I think it's another one of those things that is kind of a swerve from what you would normally expect from this kind of film. But, you know, one of the things that really surprises me about this film is just how far out of the way this movie does go to avoid all of the cliches of the giallo genre. First of all, you know, we've been talking about this, and it would seem obvious to anyone who hasn't even seen the movie, but from the jump, we know who the killer is. We see his face. Yeah. We're not seeing, you know, mysterious black gloved hands do all these crimes and it becomes a murder mystery. We know who the murderer is. There's never any doubt from like the opening 10 minutes of the movie. We know who this guy is.
It feels in some ways like the setup, as well as Hitchcock, it could be Columbo as well. It's more a how are they, it's like the story is, how are they going to catch him? What's going to happen to make all this? Because this is clearly all going to go wrong.
Right.
Giorgio is not going to get away scot-free. So the thrill comes from knowing how that's all going to play out.
Yeah, how is this going to unravel? And also, I think I was just going to say that I think that it's also kind of a bit of a shock in that most of the time, you know, another thing it dispenses with is the whole person under suspicion who, you know, isn't actually a policeman or a detective who has to find, you know, who has to explore this whole problem that he's involved in and actually solve the murder themselves. That's nowhere near this. That has nothing to do with this.
That's true. There's really basically no detective work in this movie.
No.
The main detective just sits back and waits for it to all fall to bits.
Because he has got it figured out from the beginning. He has latched on to what turns out to be absolutely the truth, and in Like you say, in most cases, the rich wife turns up dead. It's probably the husband.
Yeah.
But the that's another thing that where it kind of this film turns the genre on its head, in that often in giallos you won't even see the police. I mean, there's maybe like a couple of moments with the cops, and then they're out of the center of the story because we're focused on other things. But in this movie, the cops are, or even worse than that, sometimes the cops are just idiots, or they won't turn loose of their thoughts on who actually is the killer is, and we know they're wrong because we're following this character and we know that he can't be the killer. In this, the cops are smart. The detective, the inspector played by Eduardo Fajardo, he's figured it out pretty much from the beginning, and he's just trying to figure out how he's going to catch the guy.
I mean, in some ways you could say he's the spider. He just sits still in the middle and lets the bad guys get themselves caught.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to look at it either, because that way you can almost see three characters within the movie who can almost be seen to be spiders.
Yeah. And there's only like one it's a quite a small cast, really. There's only a few characters involved, and and Laura, who we've just talked about, Christina Galbo, she's the only sympathetic one in all of them.
True.
The rest of them kind of all get what's coming to them in some way or other. But yeah, I don't want to talk any more about the plot. We've established enough there that the killer has got to go off after Laura and Luca. They've inadvertently stolen a car with a body in the trunk. Meanwhile, Giorgio is back at home just waiting for that all-important call that's supposed to come through from the kidnappers. He's starting to wonder whether something has gone wrong because the kidnappers haven't called. The detective is increasingly suspicious and just sits there waiting for it to all fall apart. And we just get to watch. So, yeah, I think this is great. I've never seen it before. And I'm really glad that I did. And it does make me surprised that Luigi Cozzi didn't make any more. But I suppose, as we've established, by this time, there were so many of these films.
Yeah.
And we know that Cozzi really wanted to make fantasy movies and sci-fi. I think that's where his heart really was. So maybe it was his own choice not to make any more. But this is, I think this is great. I highly recommend this for everybody who hasn't seen it.
Oh yeah, definitely. This is an exceptional little film, and it's the perfect movie to watch if you think you've seen you think you've seen whatever the giallo genre can throw at you. This one plays it up and does some different things that you just aren't expecting, and that's one of the joys of the genre, is it's such a strong genre that even a film that really kind of just walks away from some of the most basic conventions of it can still be one and still be really effectively exciting and fit within the genre and really feel like the kind of thing that you're going. I mean, regardless of anything else, even if you decided that you're going to be hidebound about the genre definition and say that this really doesn't fit the giallo thing because it is so, it does play against so many of the conventions of the genre, then hey, still, it's a hell of a thriller. It's a really effective movie. And it's so sure-footed in what it's doing. It's tight. It's mean. There's almost no fat on this. But the things that can seem to confound some viewers that I've noticed over the years is that weird period in the middle where the killer is trying to chase down the people who the couple who stole in his car, and it is such a weird turn from this kind of movie that it seems to make some people who really love the genre feel like it kind of does something that doesn't work. And I'm like, no, man, that is just incredibly effective stuff.
Yeah, no, it's great. One thing just to mention as well, just before we finish the film, so. Apparently, Cozy wanted to call it the Spider, but it was the distributors who came up with a much more giallo sounding title, The Killer Must Kill Again, which is the ultimate giallo title. But the actual Italian, the direct translation from the Italian is The Killer Is Forced to Kill Again, which I think adds a slightly different perspective on it, because The Killer Must Kill Again just makes it sound like it's a psycho who can't help himself. But the killer is forced to kill again. is more fitting to the plot.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of being blackmailed into killing again, rather than just being an unhinged serial killer. So the title is slightly misleading, I think, from that point of view. And I think that the idea of him, he's kind of having to be a killer again. It's almost like he doesn't want to kill all these people. He just has to, keep doing it to fix his mess.
Well, I mean, and that is true. I mean, that's one of the more amusing things about this is that if you play the game, well, when he's doing away with that body at the beginning, or what if that's the first time he's ever killed anybody? You know, it's clear that he's arranging this so that it looks like the woman, you know, if they find it, was behind the wheel of the car. And it's clearly her car. He's getting rid of her in her own car. So he's trying to cover his tracks effectively here. And the thing, of course, there are things that mitigate against that idea because he's perfectly willing to go along with this. But I just wanted to ask real quick. Kotze admits that the story of this is kind of an expansion of an episode of the door in the darkness.
Oh, right,
The TV series that he did Argento was kind of the host of, and different directors did a couple of episodes.
Yeah,
and it's an anthology TV series essentially. But the episode that Kotze did himself was called "The Neighbor," and this is essentially just an expansion of that. But at the same time, here's what's terrible. Have you seen it? Because I haven't. No. I have it, and I haven't watched it. And I intended to, but at the same time, I thought, well, no, I kind of want to talk about this film as a piece and not have that earlier reference thing to kind of cloud my judgment on, you know, what we discuss in this. But have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen any of those. Is that available commercially then?
Yeah. Door in the Darkness. At least it was released on DVD.
Okay.
It was a while back.
Yeah. Okay.
So they have been made commercially available with an English option. I think it's subtitled, but I think it would have to be subtitled.
Yeah.
But
I'll check it out.
Yeah. I'm curious. Here in the next little while, I'm going to have to watch it just to see what the, just how close, just how much of an expansion it is, because supposedly this is also kind of inspired by a novel, by Giorgio. I think it's I don't know. It's an Italian name, and I'm going to screw it up. I'm not going to try. But so essentially, he seems to be taking bits and pieces from here and there. And like I say, he did a commentary track on the old Mondo DVD, and he's admitting in every instance, like when the killer brings the body out of the house and puts it in the back of the car. He's going, yeah, that's the Frankenstein shot. That's, the monster holding the passed out victim and walking toward the camera. And he's referencing all of the little Hitchcock nods here and there. He references a lot of other little things within the movie as well.
I was thinking it was a Blood and Black Lace reference, but
no, he's. It's always going to go back to those classic black and white horror films one way or another.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. That's very cool. I think it's a strong start to our Luigi Kotze mini season. We're going to take ourselves, like this film, we're going to take a left turn with the next one. We're going to have a look at Luigi Kotze's reinterpretation of Godzilla.
Hmm.
Now, is that one that you've ever seen before?
No, I have not. I've never been. Once I discovered the uncut Japanese versions of all the Godzilla films, the American versions kind of always found a way to be pale in my vision.
Sure.
So
yeah, it'll be interesting to. I'm going to watch both of them to fully appreciate. So yeah, Kotze did a sort of colorized and edited. But anyway, we'll talk about that. So that's what we're going to have a look at next time, just to see what Luigi Kotze was up to. And then we'll finish out the season with a double bill of Hercules films, and then hopefully, all being well, an interview with the man himself. So this will take us up until and just past Christmas, and then we'll begin the new year with a post-apocalypse season. That's we're also all looking forward to. But yeah, I think that's everything we can say about The Killer Must Kill Again. So thank you, Rod, for your insight and experience that you brought to that one.
Oh, I loved it. I'm shocked that I haven't talked about this movie before. So thanks for the opportunity.
Good. No problem. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We're glad to be back. Do subscribe. If you haven't, give us a review on whichever platform you listen to us on. Podchaser is another nice platform to put reviews on if you want to leave one there. What else should we say? You can make us... We're very grateful to the donations that we've received so far. If you want to donate, there is a Ko-fi button on our webpage and also on in the show notes if you'd like to buy us a virtual Ko-fi. And that's about all, I think. So until next time, thank you for listening, and bye for now.
Bye for now, folks.
I really don't know how to end these things.
You're doing fine. There is no correct way other than hitting stop. So.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.